What's different between growing and scaling that a franchisee ought to know so they're not confused?
Yeah, so I mean, I guess it just depends on kind of the thought that they're thinking about how to do it. Scaling to me is learning a system with one truck, let's say for example, and then adding more trucks. And so the first time it's going to take a while to get the hang of it. The next time you add the next truck, it's going to take less time. And then now you've got it kind of more understanding. You put, you know, managers and salespeople in place and you kind of have multiple trucks in multiple areas. So in like a brick and mortar business, scaling to me would be adding another brick and mortar location and adding another space. Yeah. Whereas with the service business, and the reason why I like service businesses is you could theoretically have as many trucks as you want within a condensed area.
Welcome to the Franchise Hot Seat Podcast, where we talk about all things franchising. Now, here's your host, Dr. John P. Hayes.
I'm back with another edition of the Franchise Hot Seat Podcast, and my guest is Aaron Harper, who's the CEO and owner of Rolling Suds. What is Rolling Suds? Is this a beer joint?
Well, hey, John, thanks for having me on today. I'm excited to talk with you. I listen to your podcast. I'm a big fan of you in general and the franchise industry. Rolling Suds, we're the national fastest growing power washing franchise, residential and commercial power washing. So cleaning buildings and structures.
So why power washing? Do we need, it's like I often say, do we need another hamburger place? Do we need another pizza franchise? Do we need another power washing? I know you have some competition.
Yeah. So, I mean, I can give you a little reason of why I decided to franchise this business, because I looked at a ton of different businesses last year to franchise, and, you know, the power washing industry as a whole right now is a bunch of guys who do it themselves. Typically, that's who the industry is kind of led by. And as I've dug into the industry, even the guys that like put on the power washing conferences are also doing it themselves, right? And so there's very little kind of like wide scale sophistication in the power washing industry at large. And I think, you know, a good franchise brand can come in and kind of set some standards and sophisticate the industry. Very similar, as you know, you've been around the block a long time, a lot longer than I have. And 1-800-GOT-JUNK did something similar to junk business in the 90s. And now there's Junk Lovers and Junking and College Hunks Hauling Junk. And really, from like a sophistication standpoint, we don't face a ton of competition. There are franchises that do power washing, but not ones that really just only focus on power washing.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So, Aaron, one of the things you say, and I want to focus on this as part of a hot seat conversation, you promote responsible franchising. What is that, and how would we recognize it?
Yeah. So I believe that responsible franchising starts with setting the proper expectations and the franchise development process. There are a lot of false promises, as you've heard, in certain different brands with the franchise development process. And so setting the right expectations of what the franchisee can expect, both good and bad, giving them everything, and then also on the back end, delivering on that promise. So there's a few things that I do to keep kind of responsible franchising growing that I've learned over the years. Operations and sales have to talk to each other. If sales is saying one thing and operations is saying something different, the franchisee suffers because they're not experiencing what they said they were, what they signed up for. So I oversee sales, I oversee the operations, so I can make sure that what's said on franchise development is actually delivered on the backside. Also, it's turning away more franchisees than you bring in, right? And knowing exactly who's going to be successful in your system and who's not. And that's easier said than done, especially for an emerging franchisor that doesn't have a ton of capital and they might just take a check because they need the check. So I personally have raised lots of money to do this the right way. And I've built systems now that support the growth that I know we're going to have. Mm-hmm. So we've got 11 people on our corporate team. In 7 months, we've sold 44 units to 15 franchisees in 12 states. I've turned away 25 people that weren't right. which, you know, 50 to 75 territories, depending on whether they got two or three units. So yeah, having the right amount of capital, setting the right expectations, bringing in the right people, turning away the wrong people, and then knowing what systems you're going to break a year from now if you add a certain number of units, and solving for that now.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's a lot more to it, but those are some things like... Okay.
So you said, you know, irresponsible franchising, a franchisor might take a check because they need to pay the bills or something. Your guess, what percentage, and let's say there are 4,500 franchise brands in North America, probably there are more. Let's say it's that. Your guess, what percentage of those 4,500 are going to take a check because they need the money, not because they know the franchisee is going to succeed?
A large percentage.
Yeah. Are you afraid to give a number?
Yeah, I don't even want to. A large percentage. And I think a lot of that goes into it, John. And this is why I think the work that you're doing is so amazing, is most people don't know how to franchise a business. They have a good power washing business and they decide to become a franchise or a franchisor. I come from a franchising background. I've put over 470 units into three brands in 6 years. All of them have opened. All of them have opened with work on the calendar before they start their business. Mm-hmm. I have a unique perspective as an emerging franchisor because I know what that's going to look like. I know I modeled out 6 years of what my expenditures are, everything of what I can expect if
this
I add
a certain
number.
This was in another position. You were with another company. Was it Belfour at the time that you did all that work?
Yes. Yep. Okay. So I was with Belfour Franchise Group and we scaled the Patch Boys up, which I know one of your students ended up buying a franchise from me.
Sold last Monday, I think. Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
And you know, one of the interesting things they said, they probably should not have been sold a franchise, even though they did okay. One of the two was in my classroom last week and taught me something. Even though I say to people always, and I have for 40 some years, if you're going to buy a franchise, you've got to buy a franchise that you're compatible with the operating system and that it's going to generate your wealth. But you also have to find it satisfying work.
Right.
And these two young men did not. They said at the end of the day, how do we get excited about patching a hole in a wall?
Yeah.
Not that the top franchisees aren't excited about whatever it means to people about patching a hole in the wall. These two fellows were looking for passive income and didn't want to be working in the business. And
That wasn't made clear to me. I assure you of that, because the minute that someone tells me they want something passive or semi-passive on that first call, I immediately get them out of the process because I take issue with that because I think a lot of businesses are being sold as passive or semi-passive and they might not be. I do know that they ended up buying an Ellie Mental Health kind of shortly thereafter.
Well, I wasn't going to get into that to that point, but the passive income issue before the pandemic, and I would say, which, you know, my career in franchising started in 1979. If someone said passive income, a franchisor usually would say, this isn't network marketing. And that's not a slam against network marketing.
Right.
I wrote the book about network marketing with Zig Ziglar many years ago. So great respect for network marketing. Franchising is not for passive income people. Franchising is not for that the father who visited me when I was CEO of Homevestors and said, my son's graduating from college and I want to buy him a Homevestors. We need to be in real estate. Well, that's one that we passed on if your heart's not in it, you're not in it protecting your money, probably not going to succeed in franchising.
Right.
Since and even slightly before the pandemic, I believe, but particularly since the pandemic, franchising, offering franchises to people who want passive income, What is going on? I think it's a mistake. I don't want to knock anybody, but I'm not so sure this is going to be in our best interests as franchisors and franchisees moving forward.
It's not, John. And that's why I promote responsible franchising, because I'm on the next generation of franchisors. I'm 35 years old. You know, some of my other friends that are doing the same thing I'm doing, and I believe doing it responsibly. But, you know, you have this kind of disconnect from a franchisor who doesn't know how to sell franchises. And so he hires a company that's all they do is sell franchises. But the way they sell franchises is by saying it can be passive or semi-passive a lot of the times.
Scary.
And so there's. Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, it's scary. I mean, I don't know where this is going to go. And I'm a bit fearful. A lot of my students want passive income. And I discourage it from day one.
What I tell candidates is when you start, because like the candidates we're looking for, and this is what I go when I go back to saying, like, know what type of buyer is going to be successful in your system, is I'm looking for someone who wants to buy a business, not a job. But initially, when you buy a franchise, you learn everything. You learn how the cost of goods sold work. You learn how to manipulate the P&L. You learn how to recruit. You learn how to train. You learn how to do all that. And then you start firing yourself from roles, and that's how you scale a business. And so I'm bringing in people who want to build really big businesses, but understand that it's going to take work to figure that out at the beginning to then eventually get to having a business that can eventually run with staff in place. But I think there's this misconception that, like, you can buy a franchise because there's systems in the franchise, hire a general manager and kind of set it and forget it. And I don't think that works.
No. So perfect segue in what you just said, because the next thing on my list of what I want to talk to you about is you had a post recently that said, are you ready to scale? And I think a lot of people are confused about, first of all, what is scale? And you went on to say, emerging franchise brands need to think about a structure for scaling right from the start so they don't build a model that can't support growth. And having the ability to scale quickly is why we have a minimum purchase requirement of 2 territories. It provides room to grow and to add trucks. Grow a big business with us and contact me today. All right. Now, if I didn't, and I do know you, so I mean, I've met you in person once, maybe twice, and we hang out at the same places lots of times. Springboard, I didn't see you because it was just too big. I didn't see, you know, 650 of the people who were there. Here's what worries me about this. Okay, is this an excuse to sell somebody 2 territories when they really ought to get a grip on one, and then buy the second one maybe a year later?
Yeah. So a lot of people, there's 2 things. One, a lot of people will buy 1 territory because they're a little bit more cautious and they want to do that. And then they go into the business not with the mindset of a multi-unit owner. So my coaches train franchisees at the very beginning to think like a multi-unit franchisee, take the least amount of money out of the business, put as much money back into the business. You're thinking about this to get to as many trucks as you can possible. A lot of franchisors will sell 1 unit. Then they'll sell the unit next to them and the unit next to them and the unit next to them. And all of a sudden that person can't scale their business.
Right.
And so I found that 2 to 3 to start is a good starting point. Part of my responsible franchising that I do is unless they've built and scaled a business before, I will not sell them more than 3 units, period. And I get asked that all the time. I want all of Long Island, or I want all of Philadelphia or whatever. And it's like, I'm not. And a lot of franchisors will be like, I'll sell you 10 territories. And then they only open 2. Right. And so part of it goes into the coaching strategy that's behind the sale, which is we're going to make sure you have enough capital to get to that next truck within, you know, the first 6 to 12 months is our goal. And then we take part of the upfront investment and invest it back into ad spend. So a lot of franchisors, as you know, do a grand opening budget, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
We take part of the franchise fee and the investment and we invest it back in for 6 months into ad spend for them and control
and
that budget.
What is your franchise fee in the startup investment for a 2-unit, 2-territory franchise?
Our franchise fee is $39.9.
Okay. And then you take some of that and put it into advertising as opposed to relying on the franchisee to pay for advertising or relying on a national ad fund plus, which, you know, you probably wouldn't be very big at this point with 40 some franchises.
Right.
This is great. Yep. That I think that's part of your responsible franchising. And I certainly applaud you for that. Something else I applaud you for, Aaron, you celebrate your franchisees as a CEO. You know, you're not depending on the director of sales to say, hey, we just sold a new franchise. You're out there as the CEO owner celebrating your franchisees and also your employees. And that, again, is part of responsible franchising. And I'm happy to see you doing that.
Thank you.
So back to another, some more about scaling. You know, it's growing. It's growing a business, scaling. What's different between growing and scaling that a franchisee ought to know so they're not confused?
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess it just depends on kind of the thought that they're thinking about how to do it. Scaling to me is learning a system with one truck, let's say, for example, and then adding more trucks. And so the first time it's going to take a while to get the hang of it. The next time you add the next truck, it's going to take less time. And then now you've got it kind of more understanding. You put, you know, managers and salespeople in place and you kind of have multiple trucks in multiple areas. So in like a brick and mortar business, scaling to me would be adding another brick and mortar location and adding another space. Yeah. Whereas with the service business, and the reason why I like service businesses is you could theoretically have as many trucks as you want within a condensed area. Yeah.
Is it more important to the franchisor to scale the business than it is to the franchisee?
No, because the franchisee needs to be profitable. And in order for the franchisee to be profitable, they need to get to multiple trucks because their fixed costs go down as they add more trucks and generate more revenue. So you've heard me say this online that we're a franchisee company. And I mean that. So if we're a franchisee company, it's super clear what we do. We provide services to franchisee. I see franchisors as a service company. We provide services to franchisees. And in return for those services, we're paid a royalty. And as their business grows, they're going to need additional services that they didn't need when they first started. And so the services that we provide the franchisees need to innovate as their business grows so we can continue to earn the royalty that we get. And I don't think that a lot of franchisors think that way. I think it's like, you get in my system, you do what I say you're going to do, and then you pay me a royalty forever. And like, that's not an exciting experience for someone who's starting a business. They're relying on us to help them grow their business. And so when a franchisee in the development process says to me, well, I only really want one truck, maybe two in the whole process, I'll just tell them they're not right for the business. That's not who we're looking for. And that's okay. There are opportunities out there where they don't have to scale.
No.
But we're looking for people who want to build massive businesses.
Okay. And not everybody should build a massive business. They don't have the talent to do it.
Correct.
So it's responsible to identify them up front, not allow them into the system. And I congratulate you for doing that because it's not easy to pass up even a small check when you're an emerging franchisor.
Yep. Thank you.
The idea that you have then immediately goes to, you've got to be a multi-unit operator. You've got to think. And most people don't know how to think like a multi-unit operator because they've never done this before. So I think this goes back to what you've said about the franchisor being responsible for understanding how to structure the business so that they can support the growth that a three territory, six territory, 20 territory franchisee is going to need. So how do you do that? What are you putting in place to make sure you're going to support these massive businesses owned by a single franchisee?
Yeah. So our business coach is a former multi-unit Dunkin' franchisee. So he had eight locations and he's about 50% travel for franchisees. So my guidance to him is you need to understand the franchisee's business as much or even better than they do and help them drive behaviors that increase the numbers in the P&L and help them accomplish their goals. We also have them model out after they've signed a franchise agreement. There's 10 weeks before they open. During that time, they're modeling out what the next 5 years are going to look like. And then our coaching ties back to those goals and those benchmarks to help them get there. And so a lot of being a multi-unit franchisee, you have to have capital. So the franchisees who come into the system, they have to have $200,000 to $250,000 in cash. We're not doing SBA loans. We're not doing unsecured lending. Like, they got to have it in assets and be comfortable deploying it. And the other part of it is it's mentality. It's thought process. The guy who wants to just get $100,000 salary out of one truck, that's an employee mindset. And a lot of people, as you know, buy into a franchise with an employee mindset. Absolutely. So we have them shift and say, no, it's not about salary anymore. It's about enterprise value. That's what it's about. You're building a business that's an asset. Mm-hmm. So you need to think that way. And so we teach them to think that way before they've even opened their doors. Okay. And then we tie their behaviors back to their original model and hold them accountable to achieve the things that they told us they want to do.
Great. Do you use the DISC profile?
We do not.
I wish
I had a science to what I did, John. I'd replicate it to everyone else. I do the franchise development internally, start to finish, myself. Mm-hmm. So I use my gut. My gut is currently not scalable. So we're working on that. But I do it myself. I've delegated everything else to my team. I've got 11 people on my team that work all across the country. I handle the franchise development process because in an emerging brand, the first 25 franchisees who come into a system, they set the standards. Yep. And if they're not excellent, you have a really hard time selling franchises later.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So why not use a profile? And there's so many different ones. They're all built on DISC. And it's been around since the 1950s. It is so insightful. I don't even teach a student without giving them the DISC profile.
I need to look into it, honestly. I've seen you post about it. I'm not opposed to it particularly. I've just never used it in my process with the other brands that I worked on. But yeah, I'm kind of indifferent. I absolutely should look into it though.
When I was the CEO of Homevestors of America, We Buy Ugly Houses, we lived by the DISC, and it proved itself over and over.
That's awesome.
If you were not doing well in our system, it was because you did not have enough D in your DISC personality. And you could replace that by hiring someone. We could compare the top 25 franchisees to the bottom franchisees. And the only thing that was missing, there were no differentiations in our training. What was missing was the D in their personality. And without that D, they could not go out and buy houses at a discount. It just wasn't in them. Even though our training was outstanding and our coaches were outstanding. If you don't have it in you, you can't do it. And that was a quick peek to what they had in them. And I'll be happy to talk to you anytime about the DISC. We could do that. So I want to move on to another topic. You talk about how to do it right as a franchisor. So what's different about an emerging brand other than it's new? It doesn't have any franchisees or only has a few franchisees. What's different about the emerging brand that you need to emphasize the importance of doing it right?
So a franchise that doesn't have any franchisees yet is burning capital, right? Mm-hmm. And so you need to have a certain amount of capital, and you need to know exactly what that amount of capital is to get you to a certain number of units open. In order to do that, you have to take a huge step back and look at what your cash outlay is going to be. Who are you hiring? When are you hiring the next person? What does that look like? And so when I say doing it right, you have to zoom out and be able to do that. And then you should not franchise until you have that amount of capital in the bank ready to deploy. And I tell that emerging franchisors find me, I love giving free advice to emerging franchisors. Like, it's one of my hobbies. And they find me and they ask me, well, how much capital do I need? What do I do? This and that. And a lot of the time, they're not being told by the all franchise your business space that they need a certain amount of capital. They're getting an FTD together with $50,000 in the bank, or they're being brought on by a franchise sales organization and all they have is $75,000. And you'd think I was lying, but both of those scenarios happened in the last 2 weeks.
I know they're true.
And so because they came to me and asked, I was like, do not franchise. That's a terrible idea. Like save money or go raise capital. And so doing it right is knowing what you can handle and what you can't handle. And whatever you can't handle, hire for and pay that person. Pay someone in franchising as a director of operations to get your units open. And you go be the salesperson. You do the discovery days and you talk to candidates. But you need someone who can operationally support franchisees. Now, again, I'm fortunate in the sense with years of experience working at Belfour Franchise Group and other companies that I know what that looks like. And I've been able to learn from those experiences. And so franchisees that buy into Rolling Suds get that experience, which is, I think, part of the reason why we're selling and opening so many units. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so a lot of franchisors, emerging franchisors, they'll sell a ton of units and they'll only open a fraction of them. And that's not doing it right. That's doing it irresponsibly.
Mm-hmm. How do you step back to do this analysis? Most emerging franchise, I say most, and I think that's probably right. They've never franchised before. And many, if not most, have no experience. They don't even know what franchising is. Right. They attend an IFA convention. They go to Springboard. Great place to go. And okay, now I'm a master at this. Or I know how to figure it out. No, you don't know how to figure it out. I've had clients in franchising 10, 20, 25 years, and they'll be the first to say, we haven't figured it out. Now they've been successful. They're exaggerating, but there's always more to figure out. So how would somebody who builds a business successfully, operates it for 5 years and says, let's go franchise this. When they step back, they don't know what to analyze. They don't know why they would need $75,000. Or why they would need $750,000. What do you tell them? How can you give them a list to
that's a phenomenal that's these a, things? That's a phenomenal question because it absolutely is true that I don't believe there's enough education for emerging franchisors, mm-hmm. which is why I have such a ton of respect for what you do at the Titus Center. Because you need to know how a franchise works. So, I mean, like one of the things they can do is they can get their CFE credits from the IFA. They should probably do that before they decide to franchise. For those who don't know, CFE is Certified Franchise Executive. You'll go through courses, you'll go to attend conferences, and you'll learn. I think that, before they even sell a franchise, they're going to need this is what I tell people, you're going to need $200,000 before $200,000 to $250,000 before you've even sold a unit.
I agree.
And that's before you can even support the franchise. And people are blown away by that number because they weren't told that in their kind of, I'm franchising my business. Mm-hmm. Then they're going to need to have, I say the three first hires are going to be kind of a catch-all person who can do kind of everything, like from an office perspective for the franchise. You need someone who's got good operational experience, ideally in franchising, that can build systems for training and opening the units. And then you need a salesperson or a sales organization, and you need to be super, super firm with who you'll allow in the system and who you won't. And if someone tells you that in order to be part of their organization, you have to be able to sell your business as absentee or semi-absentee, or they want a percent of the royalties, or they want equity in the business, run in the opposite direction, because that's not what they should be doing. And so I wish there was more education. I'm going to start putting out more free content, telling people what I know. I want to be able to help at scale. So you'll start to see more videos and more blog posts from me trying to help people. But yeah, there's not a resource of like, go to this place and you can learn how to become an emerging franchisor.
And yet you've got Springboard, you've got the IFA's emerging conference. There are places to go, and I think they're well attended. But that's just not enough. A lot of that is just the highlight. It's only hitting the surface of information. And oftentimes there are too many people at these events that just want to sell you their services. And that's not what you need at this point. You need more education. It's not easy to find it, as you're saying. So how do you spot the company? What's the two or three things that you'll spot most often that says they're doing it wrong?
Number one is selling more units than they can feasibly open. Number two is selling the units to the wrong people who have the wrong expectations in what they can expect. And then number three is just not building the support structure to actually make those franchisees profitable or help give them the path to profitability. I mean, I could probably dial that in a little bit more, but those are the three things that I see that are super problematic. I mean, I see more 5-unit semi-absentee deals sold per year than it's just, that's what I'm seeing.
Yeah.
And it's concerning. And I don't know that there's a lot of people who are selling 50 to 100 units a year to people who are actively involved in the business, who have the proper expectations of what they can expect when they leave training, and then also getting delivered on those promises. And so my hope is that by what we're doing at Rolling Suds, we can provide kind of a path and maybe a bit of an example of how to do it the right way, so that it can say, hey, you know, this is how Aaron did it, or this is how Rolling Suds did it, or this is how some of the other people who are in kind of my generation, who I believe are doing it right, can kind of clap back to that emerging franchisor that doesn't know anything about franchising. It's like, well, this is kind of how you do it.
For the last 40 years, I have been speaking at easily a half dozen franchise expos / conferences every year. And oftentimes not just some of the time, but every time I go to an expo, I'll walk around to see who's there and talk to old friends and make some new friends. And the new friends are emerging franchisors. And so the question will be, so how long you been doing this? And they'll say, oh, I'm a year and a half into this since I had my first FDD. Okay. And how many units have you, how many franchisees do you have? I don't have any, or I have two. How does this happen that unless they don't know how to sell a franchise, which they don't, or the concept isn't any good, which might be the case. Look how much money just to get an FDD. You can be talking about easily $25,000, if not $50,000. Right. And people are spending that for what? You haven't even sold a franchise, and your franchise fee is only $30,000. So you've got to sell a bunch of them just to break even on that $250,000 overall that you invested. How is this happening so often that so many people become franchisors, but in name only?
So I believe that it needs to start with the proper expectations being set to those emerging franchisors when they go to the legal departments and when they go to the kind of consultants that do the, you know, FDDs and stuff like that. And the proper expectations need to be set at that point. I'm not going to take your $25,000 or your $50,000 or your $100,000 unless you've got X number of capital in the bank ready to actually support franchisees. Or, you know, and there's so I think it starts there. And I think that if people knew, franchisors knew that they need to have $500,000, $1 million, $1.5 million, $2 million in the bank, depending on what their concept looks like, I think less people would become franchisors, which honestly, the amount of franchisors that open and the amount of franchisors that close every year, less franchisors wouldn't be a bad thing. Now, more franchisors who know what to expect and how to deliver on promises would be a great thing. But I believe it starts at kind of the, I want to franchise my business space. And John, I played in that space for the first time last year because I looked at 24 businesses to franchise. There's a lot of stuff going on in that space that, you know, is discerning. You know, there's a lot of equity for access plays going on. There's a lot of, right. And I think that if the proper expectations were set with the franchisor that wants to become a franchise on how to be successful, and there was a path given to that person to do that, we'd have a lot more successful franchisors and therefore franchisees, right? Because that's ultimately what we're doing here, is we're providing paths to business ownership for franchisees. And so we have to know exactly how to do that before we start doing it.
It would be easy to conclude, if you followed me around an expo and heard these answers, that it must be really hard to sell a franchise. And yet you've sold 44 in 7 months, 44 territories to 15 franchisees in 7 months. Doesn't sound like it's so hard for you, Aaron.
So our mission statement, you probably see this online. Our mission statement is, this is a relationship. Has nothing to do with power washing. Business, my business and my life is built on meaningful relationships. So I have very deep ties to franchise consultants. So they're called brokers in some spaces. And these franchise consultants know and trust me, and they know exactly what I'm looking for in a candidate. They do not bring me someone who wants semi-passive or semi-absentee or absentee. They know me better than that. They also know that if they sell a unit, the candidate that they have buys one of my units, they're going to get open and they have a very good chance of being successful. But that took me years to establish. And it took me cold calling consultants to find the right ones that I can work with. And now, you know, because of the reputation that I have and the relationships I've established, we're able to get the right people into the right seats in our system. And that's hard to do. And so that's why a lot of people will go to the franchise sales organizations, because they already have those pre-existing relationships. But without those types of relationships or that experience, you're right, it is very hard to sell a unit. Mm-hmm.
So what's better, or what's easier, or what do you recommend, the FSO versus a broker network when you're an emerging franchisor?
So those are two separate things. If you do an FSO, you still use a broker network. So you're going to basically, no matter what, in that scenario, use brokers. The difference is do you have the franchise sales organization sell the units, or do you hire someone internally to sell units as well? So I actually was just on a panel, broker versus organic, with Alicia, Visconti from
France. Member of my advisory board. She's terrific.
Yeah, her and I are very, very close. I do almost all my deals with her network almost exclusively. And it was the broker versus organic piece. And basically the panel was like, you need to expect that 90% of your franchise fee is going to go towards the FSO and the brokers, which means that emerging franchisor needs even more capital than they did before, right? So because we do franchise development in-house, we're able to keep a good portion of the franchise fee and invest it back into infrastructure. So we've been profitable every month since we started awarding franchises so that we could support franchisees. So when I talk to a emerging franchisor, I say, hey, if you hire a franchise sales organization, A, be super firm with what you're looking for and what you're not looking for. That's the same whether it's in-house development or external development. And B, you're going to need a considerable amount of money, $2 to $250, in order to get that first unit sold, whether you're joining all the broker networks or not. The organic side of things, it's you're either going to spend actual capital or time capital. And when you're doing organic, you're paying in advance for a potentially higher profit margin but you're paying in advance, and the amount of time that you need to go through all of those organic leads takes a tremendous amount of time. So I would recommend that they do it in-house personally. I think it's the only way to truly control what the franchisee is experiencing on the front lines, because the franchise developer, that's their first window into the culture of the business. They're on the front lines. And if that's a bad experience or it's a misguided one, then that could set the franchisee and the franchisor up for a ton of failure. Yeah. And so I recommend doing it in-house. So I say that there are franchise developers out there who like to get involved in emerging brands that have had success working at different companies before. So to find those people and prepare to pay well for them. But that would be my recommendation, just because that's what I do and that's how I'm having success. But I know that a lot of emerging franchisors don't do it that way.
So that will sound confusing to some people, because you rely on brokers to bring you the opportunities, the leads. But you do the selling yourself in-house. The broker just makes the introduction for you.
Correct. The broker is a lead source. Yeah. I do the entire franchise development process, but I also do a ton of top of the funnel work with brokers, so they know exactly about my business model, how to present it the proper way, what to expect, what not to expect. And I have those relationships. But yes, brokers or organic, that's a lead source. Franchise sales organization or in-house development would be the conversion on franchisees to actual or candidates to franchisees.
But the commission to brokers is extremely high. So you're giving up a big percentage of your $39,000 fee.
Correct. But the way our cost structure works and the way my commission is structured is we have more than enough from that in order to support the franchisees.
Okay. The many franchisors have said to me, if my fee is only $40,000, I'm going to end up having to give all of that to the broker. True or not?
And what I can tell you is that's not our situation. Our situation is because of my reputation, we do not pay as much because they know that the franchisees are going to get taken care of. And they know, I'll tell them, we need this capital to invest in the franchisees' success. Sure. Mm-hmm. And the ones that I work with, they know that. And they know me and trust me. And so we're able to get deals done that way.
But is there truth to, well, you know, if I can make a $40,000 commission over here, or I can make a $25,000 commission over here, how many brokers are not going to go for the $40,000 commission?
So this is kind of one of my things. I don't work with a lot of those brokers. Mm-hmm. I have a very specific set of brokers who know me inside and out. And I don't go to the ones who want a $70,000 commission for sending someone who wants a passive investment. Like, I just don't work with that broker.
That's not what you do. And by the way, I'm sure one of those brokers is our friend, Brian Beers, who was also on my podcast. And he's a multi-unit with his brother, Midas franchisee, one of my favorite, also on my advisory board, and one of my favorite brands, the Midas brand. Brian is a terrific guy. And
he's amazing.
I hope he brings you good deals. A lot of them.
Brian and I have become very close this year. I've been on his podcast as well. And we both believe in responsible franchising and talk about responsible franchising all the time. He came out, as you just saw, this past weekend, and our families met. And it's, you know, I think there's a lot to say about, hey, I'm doing it responsibly and I want the franchisee to be successful. And I try to work with consultants that believe in that more than they believe in, you know, a bigger commission check or whatever. And it's worked out for me. But, you know, I hear what you're saying about, you know, kind of standing out.
Yeah. So you said that most of your business, I think this is right, you said most of your business with brokers is coming from one group. Is that right? And
correct.
So do I have to work with several of these groups or 100 brokers? Is it better for me to zero in on one group and find 10 brokers?
Yes, it's better for you to focus on one group, no more than two groups, depending on how much time you have, and focus on developing the relationships with those consultants. I see a lot of emerging franchisors that'll be like, I joined 17 networks or 10, 12 networks, and I'm not getting any leads.
Right.
And they spent $200,000 and they think that they need to now get all those leads, but it's all relationships. They're only going to present the brand if they believe in you, your brand, and your ability to sell the units and also get them open. And so that's, I mean, I would recommend, and this is again, what I tell emerging franchisors, join one, maybe two, call every single broker in that group and try to learn about who they are and what they like, and then try to figure out if your brand makes sense for them. Mm-hmm. And if it does, then develop that relationship and continue calling and calling and calling until you do.
Yeah. So Aaron, what we're learning from this a lot is the importance of the relationship. I think a lot of people minimize that this is just a business transaction. I'm going to sell you the rights to open my business under my name, and I'm going to give you the guidebook of everything to do from A to Z. That's not it. You've got to have a relationship with the franchisee and the franchisee with the franchisor in order to really scale your business and grow a massive enterprise.
Absolutely. The relationship, I mean, that's why it's our mission statement. Everything ties back to our mission statement of this is a relationship. It both explains how we're doing what we're doing and also why we're doing what we're doing in our mission statement.
Well, Aaron, I want to thank you. This was great information, very useful to to both franchisors and franchisees, and you didn't skirt any of the issues. You've talked very frankly about what it takes, the importance of doing it right, and how easy it is to identify the people who aren't doing it right, who really make a mess of franchising and make it more difficult for us to say that it's the greatest opportunity for the right people matching themselves to the right franchise brand. And that doesn't always happen.
Right. Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it. It's been great.
Yep. And I want to wish you the best of luck as you go forward and continue doing the wonderful things you're doing. Come to the Titus Center, visit my students at some point. Our advisory board is always open to you. We now have 101 members of that group. And we couldn't do it without their support. And what we're doing is educating the next generation of franchisees, but also of employees in franchising. Most of my students, 97%, want to be franchisees. They don't want to take a job. They will, because usually they need money to put back to become a franchisee. But this Gen Z group that we're educating now, this is the future of business ownership and particularly franchising. So come and visit.
Yeah, I will. I definitely will.
Thanks for tuning in to the Franchise Hot Seat Podcast with Dr. John P. Hayes. Tune in next time for more conversation around all things franchising.